You know ID in the D in the town all day. ID in the D in the SEA. You know ID in the D in the town all day. ID in the D in the SEA.
Hello and welcome to episode number 36 of the Fabulous Pelton Cast. I'm your co-host Kevin Pelton.
And I'm Tristan Caracino.
And we are coming to you live from Renton, Washington, home of the Super Bowl 48 champion, Seattle Seahawks. And we'd like to begin today with a toast. A congratulations on Baby Fantasy Genius number 3. You're wearing the Chance the Rapper 3 hat, and I feel like that's only fitting for Baby number 3.
Okay, I thought we were toasting. I have a lot of things to say.
I thought we were toasting too.
I thought we were toasting to my fantasy football victory.
Oh, that's you're right. The real important things in your life in the last week.
A lot has happened, but that's the main thing. Currently being the fantasy football champion. I mean, you call me fantasy genius for a reason, right? And I had to prove to the listener that I am a fantasy genius.
By winning, well, we were...
Nobody calls me parenting genius.
That is for sure. Nobody calls you twee about the birth of your child genius either.
But I said, no matter how many children I have, you can't keep me away from the Fabulous Pelton Cast.
That's true.
I could have had 2, 3, 4 quintuplets, septuplets, octuplets.
Are you trying to have as many children as fantasy championships? You have a tough time keeping up.
I'd have to have a child every single year.
Well, not every year, not last year. And it was a little dicey. You were worried this year. But
I'm worried every year.
Then a Devontae Adams touchdown and 2-point conversion combo sealed it.
That really sealed it for me. And as I've noted very publicly, and would like to take this opportunity to, I've won the league that we both participate in, which how many times have you won?
That would be none.
0 times.
As many times as the listeners.
No, some of the listeners have won.
That's true, I guess.
We've been playing in the same league for how many years? 10 years?
I think we concluded it was 9 years, right?
No, 10.
10?
10 years, and only 3 other people have won the championship.
All right, yeah.
Okay. And they've each won 1 time.
That is correct.
So that's 7 for me, 3 for everybody else.
You are definitely the Bill Russell of this fantasy league, the John Wooden of this fantasy league.
So I reclaimed my rightful spot as fantasy football champion. And I was thinking, maybe for next year, maybe we should take it up a notch.
I was thinking the best way for me to win is to play a second fantasy league.
To hedge your bets? Because no, you want to lose in 2 different fantasy leagues?
Yes, and those ideas have both come in together in the idea of hosting a fantasy league for Fabulous Pelton Cast listeners. So if you are someone who is interested in that...
Sorry, listener. It's going to be listener, you, me, and one other person. No. I'm just trying to prove that I can beat you in another fantasy league.
A 3-team league. If you are interested in that, let us know, and we'll think about putting that together next August.
You're going to be the commissioner, naturally.
Yes.
You should maybe even take yourself out of it. Just spare yourself, but the listener would like to play against you.
Yeah, I mean, that'd be a lot of fun. It's not going to be fun to play against you, because you'll always be losing.
Because I'll always be losing?
No, the other person will always be
losing. What if I'm terrible, though? It's like really putting my money where my mouth is.
That's my hope.
Is that what if I'm just terrible? We do a Fabulous Pelton Cast fantasy league, and I'm like 7-9 or something.
That'd be really weird that we're playing a 16-week regular season. It's like the English, it's like a European soccer league. We go strictly regular season. Actually, I think that's a genius idea.
That is pretty brilliant. What if I'm the Jeff Fisher of the Fabulous Pelton Cast fantasy league?
Oh, man. No. Then you will not get fired for so long.
But I'm thinking 12 teams, right? If we can come up with 12 listeners who are even remotely interested
Let's not promise anything here.
It's us plus 10, right?
That's the invite list.
So the listener is going to have 10 different teams, and they can choose to consolidate all those players onto one team, whatever they'd like to do. We'll revisit this, but if this is something that you're interested in, however you would reach out to you or me, just do that.
Twitter, Facebook, text message, any of those.
Any means of communication.
Carrier pigeon, banner hanging behind a plane. It feels a good one.
Don't do that. But we have a lot to get to, right? Not just my various victories.
We do,
toast,
including actually toasting.
And what are we toasting with here?
We are toasting with the Fremont Lush IPA.
The brand new Fremont Lush IPA.
I mean, this is like so new. It was first out What?
January 2nd, I believe.
January 2nd. So I went to the UW game earlier this evening. We'll talk a little bit about that later. And
we're
going to
talk a lot about that later.
This was the going to Fremont was the highlight. Actually, it was the number two highlight. The highlight was going to Dick's and then also going to Fremont.
You went to Dick's also?
I did.
Okay, so imagine right now this beer that you're about to drink of your trip was when the Huskies were up in the Peach Bowl. That one touchdown.
Yes.
You're going to feel the same thing. Can I read about this really quick? Brand new Lush IPA from Fremont Brewing. What they have to say about it is, we bring this tropical treat to you.
Oh, that's good.
As a reminder of spring's coming. It's rebirth and promise of sunny days forever. Lush is made with a hand-selected blend of malts and Lush.
Define sunny days forever.
Lush tropical hops to help you bridge the last days of winter, which it doesn't feel like the last days of winter right now. The last days of winter.
Well, this is kind of like how, you know, the fall seasonals come out in like early August.
And the coming of the spring fever. We hope you enjoy this tropical treat. Keep your sunglasses handy. It is sunny.
I mean, I was wearing sunglasses earlier.
It's the guy David Caruso. Did you make a lot of puns?
I like to do that.
When you wear sunglasses, the amount of puns that you make go up even more. Did you know that Zaza stands for pizza, pizza?
You really hung up on this one tweet.
It's the worst. Okay. Sunglasses handy and wash away your cares in the coming spring rains. For a moment, nothing happened. Then, after a second or so, nothing continued to happen. To quote Douglas Adams. And what do you think of this?
This is outstanding. It says we should visit fremontbrewing.com for the current ingredient list.
Ooh.
I guess I'm going to avail myself of that opportunity here.
So we really like the beers that they had, the Field of Ferment single hop beers that they'd put out, and the Koichi Canyon. Basically everything that Fremont does is pretty much perfect.
We do, although apologies to our listener who tweeted us that they bought the B-bomb and hated the B-bomb. Apparently they do not agree with us on that one.
I guess it's an acquired taste. Not everybody loves the B-bomb, but if you like hops, I feel like Fremont has a way with hops.
They do. I went to fremontbrewing.com. It doesn't really seem to say what's in this. So that was a little bit of false advertising from the can, but I don't care because what is in it is delicious.
Okay, currently rated a dash by Beer Advocate because it's been out for 2 days. We could be the first ones to review it right here, live on the air.
We're actually, it's going to spend the entire time filling out the form.
Filling out a form, us bickering, logging in.
Deciding what to say.
Should it be one of us or should we have a Peltoncast Beer Advocate account? I'll be like, that's more of a 3.5. Oh yeah, that's great. I'm going to drink like three or four of these.
Outstanding. What else? Okay, what do we have to get to among the many things to get to? Where are we going to start?
Okay, so let's start with Husky basketball. Husky basketball. Let's get the bad. Well, actually, there's a lot of bad, honestly. Husky basketball. We've got Husky football. Recapping the season and talking about Alabama. The Seahawks against Detroit. And also, back in August, we picked the lines in the NFL, right?
We did.
Over-unders for every NFL team. We're going to look at those, and I'm feeling confident. I'm just going to say I feel good right now.
We'll see.
I have no idea the outcome of these lines, but I know that I'm feeling really good. But so you were at the Husky basketball game earlier tonight against Oregon.
I was at the game against Washington State last Sunday. Here's the thing. I'm not as down on the current Husky basketball team as most people, because I was not as high on the Husky basketball team in the first place as most people.
Who was high on the Husky basketball
team? I mean, there was the whole talk about this could be a turning point a couple weeks ago.
That was you. You said that. You said, no, quote,
I agree.
This could be a turning
I'm
point.
Confessing to
You're
that.
Like, a lot of people are saying that this could be a turning point.
That was me confessing to that. And it was basically like the Huskies, and Lorenzo Romar said this, they played four good halves in a row. The last half...
Against really bad teams.
No, well, yes. The second half against Cal Poly, the entire game against Seattle U. Actually, really, it was mostly just the second half against Seattle U, but that's neither here nor there. And then the first half against Wazoo was a pretty good half. They were well on their way to victory there.
Did Wazoo have like a 9-0 run at some point in this pretty good first half?
I think they had like a 7-0 run to cut in the lead. But the Huskies still were up, I believe, 7 going to halftime. It looked like a comfortable lead. And then it just wasn't. And... Then they lost at home to Wazoo, and that's bad.
Yeah, we were talking about having a home loss to a team ranked outside of the top 200 in KenPom.
They're not outside the top 200 anymore. They moved into the top 200.
There you go. Well, I was going to say the Huskies have their loss of their own.
And then Oregon came in tonight and just made every three they took, which, so here's an important part of why I'm not as down on this team as everyone else. There is a lot of studies that have been done. I have studied this in the NBA. Ken Palmer has done great research on this in college basketball, and it indicates that, and this is more true even in college basketball than in the NBA, teams do not control what three-point percentage their opponents shoot. We've talked about this on the podcast before, but I'm just like going to keep reiterating it because it's a really important thing. Tonight, Oregon shot 12 of 23 from three-point range.
Can I be the voice of... Not really the listener.
Actually, they shot better than that.
I think the listener probably agrees with you. But if you're wrong? I mean, consider that you're wrong.
But there's no track record of this ever. There's never been a team where you've been able to point to like, oh, that team is actually just really bad at three-point
defense.
We're
now more than halfway into
the
season.
No, but that's the point. Is like, even in a full season is not long enough for the sample size to even out.
How many years do we have to go for this to even out?
So, I mean, there's no guarantee. They were 14 of 26 tonight, by the way. There's no guarantee that things are going to even out. But there's also no reason to believe, because of the fact that Oregon, which had came into tonight shooting 33% from three-point range this season, shot 54%.
Oh, my God.
That doesn't mean the Huskies are going to be bad at defending the three going forward. Now, the fact that they got 26 threes is a concern. That's what three-point defense is preventing teams from taking threes in the first place.
Uh-huh.
But it's not about stopping them from making them. And people are like, oh, what if they're open versus contested? It just doesn't matter. It's like over time,
you don't take them if they're contested. If they're contested enough, you don't take them.
Part of the issue, which is why, again, the three-point defense is keeping teams from taking them in the first place. But, like, if you had, you know, 10,000 games, then yes, there would be meaningful differences between teams in their three-point defense. But we don't have 10,000 games. We only get 30-some.
Okay, so instead of just saying that three-point defense doesn't affect things, should we be looking at more? Should what you're looking at be different? And you should be looking at three-point attempts against?
Yes. I mean, I have a couple seasons ago, I built a spreadsheet with UW where it just put in the opponent's season-long three-point percentage and their number of attempts and said this is how many points they get for them and adjusted their ratings that way. That's kind of how I would think of it.
And what does it look like for the Huskies this year?
I mean, it's still very bad.
It's terrible.
But it's not as bad as it looks. So, I mean, again, Oregon came into the season shooting 33% from three-point range this season. That's probably a little lower than you would expect them to actually shoot, but let's go with that for the moment. Okay, so if they had shot that on the same number of three-point attempts they took tonight, you would expect them to make 8 of 26. They actually made 14. That's a difference of 6 three-pointers, which is 18 points. They won the game by 22 points. I mean, Oregon still would have won this game, but it would not have been this kind of embarrassing-looking blowout. And I guess I just, my entire prism through which I see basketball is different from the rest of the world because I don't look at how many threes go in when I evaluate how teams played.
There's something wrong about that statement. You're barely even watching the games.
No, because I'm like hyper focused on the process instead of the results. Like everyone else, they're like, watch the games, but they're really actually paying attention to the outcomes instead of the process. Now, the one thing that's...
I don't even know what to say to this argument.
The one thing that's...
What you're arguing right now is that people don't know how to watch basketball or caring about the outcome is the incorrect way to watch basketball.
I mean, obviously, there are two different elements. You know, it's not like if the Huskies have really good three-point shooting in a game and win, I'm going to be like, well, that sucked.
Terrible win.
When I'm like evaluating going forward, like the true level of play, you have to kind of distinguish between those two things. And I think coaches do tend to do this. That's why there's like the saying that the NBA is a make or miss league, which turns out to be completely accurate. And college, it's not as much a make or miss league because there are larger gaps in talent between teams. And there's other factors probably make up more of the outcome of a college game than they do the NBA game. But it's still any game of basketball, at some extent, is a make or miss game.
Well, here's what it looks like to me.
Okay.
Not necessarily just judging the process. I mean, it's frustrating when teams throw up threes and hit them constantly against the Huskies, but this is something we've come to accept. There's basically been no time in Lorenzo Romar's history where it's like, wow, teams don't just throw up crazy shots and hit them all the time. That just happens.
I mean, as I pointed out, there have been stretches where they have been extraordinarily lucky in terms of three-point defense, and they have looked better than they have. The availability heuristics suggest those are not, those don't resonate in the same way as the rest of them. But I mean, for example, last year, the Huskies, in fact, the Huskies have not allowed better than 33% three-point shooting since 2013. They're high, in fact, they haven't allowed more than 34.32% since 2008. So far this year, opponents are shooting 40.2%.
My God. Okay, so I want to hear what you think the team looks like going forward, judging just from your process-based way of viewing the game.
My God, they dropped 21 spots in the Pomeroy rankings tonight? Wow, that's a lot.
I wonder what the process has to say about that.
I mean, again,
do you think Ken Pomeroy's watching the games wrong?
He's not adjusting for
his,
this.
His stats are watching the games wrong? Anyway, they look like a discombobulated team that can't figure out, especially defensively, what they're doing. They have three different ways of playing defense. They either go zone and give teams wide open threes. They play man and can't defend people going to the paint. Or they switch everything and leave somebody wide open on every single play. And they have no... It's almost...
You forgot the offensive rebounds. I mean, that's... But that's the thing. It's like, you know, in some... The Huskies did some good things defensively tonight. They only sent Oregon to the free throw line 11 times in this game.
Those refs were very biased towards the Huskies. The refs went out... They did the Pac-12 home ref thing, but the Huskies were so bad, or Oregon hit so many threes that it didn't matter.
Oregon hit so many threes.
The Huskies were bad too. And so that's the defense. And it seems like they deploy these methods. One stops working. Then they deploy the next one that stops working. Then they deploy the next one. They have no plan going into each game. Or they do have a plan going into the game and it fails miserably right away. They give up on it. Try something else. That fails. They have no answer.
I mean, I think that's part of the issue of trying multiple different things. It's difficult to excel at any one of those. But would they just were going, you know, executing their original man-to-man at the start of the season, that wasn't super great either. Like, there's a reason they're doing this.
It's just bad. They're just bad. They're a bad team. But also, you look at them on offense, and they're an offense who doesn't really run plays. When they need to get the ball to Markelle Fultz, they can't get the ball to Markelle Fultz. Or...
And I don't agree with that.
There's,
I mean,
stretches.
Fultz took the biggest shots against Wazoo. He got to the rim twice in the last minute and missed two shots at the rim.
Okay.
Exactly what you drew up.
Well, that was a situation where they shouldn't have been in that position to begin with.
I agree with that.
They shouldn't have to rely on Markelle Fultz to hit lucky shots at the end of the game, because basically those are random shots. Even if you're Markelle Fultz, there's no extra ability to hit those shots. He took good shots and missed them, right? It's nothing about Markelle Fultz.
Yes.
But they're difficult shots to hit, and you either hit or miss them. But they shouldn't have been in that position. And you look at the game today against Oregon. There's this long stretch Oregon went on like a 17-2 run. And Markelle Fultz touched the ball very few times during that run. There's a lot of David Crisp driving to the hoop, which is very ugly. There was a play.
Fultz took 16 shots in this game. He wasn't exactly a bystander.
A lot of those shots were after the game was over. Or they were trying to catch up, being down 12-14. He's like, okay, I need to take this game over. Yeah. But when it got away from them, the ball wasn't in Markell's hands. There's so much Malik Dime in the post, Noah Dickerson in the post, because there was a loose ball where Fultz could have taken the ball. Carlos Johnson scoops up the ball, goes to the hoop, and it's an immediate turnover. It's like, what the hell are you doing? What's going on with Thybulle, too? How is Matisse Thybulle not good at offense or defense?
I don't think his defense has been bad, per se. I mean, Carlos...
He seems like he's going to be a really good player, and then he just isn't.
I don't think he's been I think he's been a perfectly fine player. He hasn't taken the step forward that I expected this season.
No.
Dickerson, though, has improved dramatically.
I like Noah Dickerson. Oh, also, Sam Timmons is clearly not a NCAA-level player.
Yeah, I mean, he shouldn't be playing this year. Marquise Chris should be playing this year.
And also
that was the plan.
They decide against Wazoo that it's going to be all Sam Timmons. Did Carlos Johnson even play against Wazoo?
He did not play in the second half after his decision-making was exceedingly poor in the first half.
And then... but there was a lot of Sam Timmons in that game.
Oregon.
They can't defend Josh Hawkinson. It's like the Wazoo offense, they can't stop. We're talking about a team who's terrible. They're outside. They were, at the time, outside the top 200 in the Ken Pomeroy rankings. And it was a puzzle that the Huskies could not figure out.
Yeah. I mean, the defense really wasn't that bad that game. I mean, I what surprises me is that the offense has declined so much from the non-conference.
There's no offense. The offense literally doesn't exist.
I mean, first off, people say that about offenses that are pick-and-roll based, and those are the best offenses.
Okay.
Like, everyone wants this, I don't know, this fancy motion shit, and it just doesn't work.
I mean, it'll seem to be
you should just run
well.
A pick-and-roll every single time.
I saw a lot of nice passing from Oregon today.
I mean, Passy is one thing. By the way, Wazoo beat Oregon State by 13. Now, Oregon State is we'll get to it, is equally bad, but
great. It's going to be another horrible loss for the Huskies.
Things are not that bad.
Okay.
They're bad. They're really bad. And the fact that things look that bad is that bad because right now perception is more important than reality for Lorenzo Robar. Which, can we talk about what I saw in Beaverton last week? Hillsboro, I guess it was?
Yes.
So I went down for the second consecutive year for the Les Schwab Invitational that is held in the Portland suburbs, where they take 12 of the best teams from Oregon and then invite four national teams, two of which in this case were from Seattle, and then a couple of other national powers. One of the teams had the top prospect from 2018, Marvin Bagley Jr.
Ed Bagley Jr.'s son.
Yes. So I was down there on Thursday.
His name is really Marvin Bagley Jr.?
I believe that's it.
Okay.
So I was down there on Thursday for Nathan Hale versus Garfield, the first matchup between these two teams.
You had to go to Oregon to see that game.
Yeah. They will be playing again at Garfield. You know what the thing is? It's actually easier to drive to Portland out to Hillsboro and go to the game than it will be to get a ticket for Garfield Hale at Garfield's gym in a couple weeks here. Because it's going to be that crowded. So,
you know, flash your ESPN.
I may have some connections I can work.
If you were verified on Twitter, you'd get in.
So Hale has the Michael Porter Jr., who is headed to UW next year, is committed to UW.
Hypothetically headed to UW.
His younger brother, Jontay Porter, who is also extremely good. And then many other talented players, coached by Brandon Roy, against Garfield, which is obviously the more traditional Seattle power. Because that's what's funny about this is Nathan Hale has been like a really bad high school basketball team for as long as anyone else can remember. It's very funny that Nathan Hale ended up at power because I have a couple of close friends who went to Nathan Hale. It's like just the last place you would think of is the number one basketball school in the team in the country right now. Garfield is the traditional power, Brandon Roy's alma mater.
Yes.
They have two UW commits next year, one of whom, Dejon Davis, did not play in this game.
Oh, really?
Because of a wrist injury. He was also at the UW game tonight, saw him there afterwards.
I'm sure he's feeling great about it after.
So they just had Jalen Noel, who's their other star. Sean Kemp's youngest son is on the team. He's a sophomore.
Oh, really?
Sophomore wing.
Wait, what's his name?
I think that's Sean Kemp the Jamar. Third. There's okay. A Jamon and a Jamar.
Both Kemp?
Yes.
Okay.
Yeah. These are kids that have grown up in Seattle with him.
Okay.
As opposed to like Sean Kemp Jr., who was in Georgia, I think. So they've got a lot of talent, but they were completely outclassed by Nathan Hale. Michael Porter is every bit. This is the first time I saw him in person. He was everything that was advertised. In some ways, looks more advanced than Markel Fultz at the same stage.
I told you, he's better than Markel Fultz.
I mean, Markel Fultz is really good. So I want to be careful with that. I've seen him one time in my life. But he's like 6'9", he's long, handles the ball really well, has legitimate, you know, college three-point range, will just dribble up and knock down a three.
Yeah, the height and the three-point range. He's a better shooter than Markel Fultz.
He's an unselfish player, makes good decisions.
That's going to be bad for him at UW next year.
Yeah, I don't think it necessarily will be.
He's going to be having awesome feeds to Sam Timmons that go right out of bounds.
You know, Noah Dickerson and David Crisp will be around at Thibault, presumably. Yeah, I mean, my main takeaway after that game is I would not do anything, that would mess with the possibility of having Michael Porter in a Husky uniform next year.
Really?
Anything.
Okay, see, we need
anything.
We need to talk about Lorenzo, right?
What's the name of that movie? There's a movie we need to talk about something, right?
We need to talk about Lorenzo. Because his job security is obviously...
Oh, we need to talk about Kevin.
We need to talk about Kevin. That's what it is. His job security is clearly not great at this moment.
There's unrest in the fan base, which is understandable given the long postseason drought and the fact that this season has turned out. I think expectations were a little bit unreasonable going in among the fan base, but it has turned out even worse than expected.
Well, the thing with Lorenzo Romar in the last 5 years or so, maybe even longer, stretching to, let's say, Tony Roten, He's had a really good ability at recruiting at the highest level.
See, I want to, I mean, at the highest level, yes.
He's had a really
But I want
good...
to talk about what he hasn't, what he, like, when people say that someone is a recruiter, they mean that as a pejorative. It's like, it's a complacent is actually what it is. And shout out to 30 Rock for coining that word.
Complacent?
It's where you pretend to be complimenting someone, but you're really insulting them. Oh, you're a really good recruiter. You know what that means? That you can't coach at all.
I mean, it sounds...
You're just
sounds
like a right. used so, car salesman.
You know, eventually, Lorenzo Romar will be a good coach. It's a 30 Rock word.
Yeah.
But as Lorenzo Romar has gotten better at recruiting at the highest level, his ability to win games has been worse. He's had recruits, maybe top five, top 10 recruits, stretching back to Terrence Ross was a very good recruit. Made one NCAA tournament.
Terrence Ross was like a 4-star.
I think by the end ended up being pretty high. Yeah. So you have Tony Roten, last year NBA prospects, maybe not huge recruits, and DeJounte Murray and Marquise Chriss.
Which is part of the issue here, is like when everyone talks about this amazing recruiting, like Marquise Chriss, what they mean by that is like, oh, you're going out and like this snake oil salesman just peddling guys. Like, that's not what happened with Marquise Chriss. They were the only ones that realized how good Marquise Chriss was. Because if anyone else had realized how good Marquise Chriss was, Marquise Chriss would not have gone to Washington. And Markel Fultz, much the same. They were recruiting him when he was in JV. That's why they got Markel Fultz. Not because of the fact that they were like better at recruiting him than Kentucky. Because of the fact that they were the only ones that saw his potential when he was 16 years old.
That doesn't change what I'm saying.
But here's the other thing.
Understanding his potential has not led to winning games. What I'm saying is that they...
Lorenzo, it's led to winning a lot more games than they would have without Markel Fultz. Let's be clear about that. Imagine what this team would look like without Markel
Fultz. I've
kind
of thought about that, too.
Think about that.
It'd be a lot more. For some reason, there'd be a lot more Sam Timmons.
He played point guard.
Sure. Yes. But also... How many years has it been since the Huskies have been to an NCAA tournament?
This will be 6 seasons.
Yeah, we could write this one off. And during those 6 seasons, he's had numerous first-round picks during that time period.
Most of whom have gone on to wildly unsuccessful NBA careers, which no one points out ever.
I personally wish them the best of luck.
I also wish them the best of luck. But if you're talking about how much talent Lorenzo Romar has had, isn't it incumbent on you to acknowledge that this talent has turned out to be a complete mirage the second they got to the NBA? What is Tony Roten doing lately? What is CJ Wilcox doing? CJ Wilcox, 4 years into his NBA career,
oh, man.
Age 27, is in the
right
D
now.
League. Actually,
God,
I think he's only 3 years.
I would love to have CJ Wilcox. But,
is it possible that CJ Wilcox might have been over-evaluated by NBA scouts who drafted him in the first round? Is it possible that Marquise Chriss, who is the worst starter in the NBA right now, might not have been that useful an NCAA player last year?
Marquise Chriss is the worst starter in the NBA?
Oh, yeah.
Who's number two?
I'd have to think about it a second. Which is kind of the point.
Like, just because players have been overrated,
but
and
that's
have been
the thing is, people are you talking about this potential, and that potential is not potential that translates into successful NCAA basketball. Now, in Markel Fultz's case, that very much is potential that translates into successful NCAA basketball, and some of the other guys it did. But people keep talking about all this talent, and I just don't see where this talent really is from an NCAA standpoint.
Okay, so making the argument here. What you're doing right now is making an argument that Lorenzo Romar doesn't have that much talent. So to negate my argument that he's not winning games with elite talent, you're saying, no, he doesn't recruit that many talented players. It's bad either way.
I agree. The thing is about a college program is that it's your coach and GM, effectively. So, yes, there's not like, oh, the players weren't good. It's the GM's fault.
Hey, you can't blame Trent Baalke here. He didn't want to draft Dak Prescott.
But here's the it was Chip Kelly that didn't want to draft.
That's what I'm saying.
Okay. You can blame Trent Baalke.
In this scenario, you can't because he's both Trent Baalke and Chip Kelly.
I see what you're saying. Okay. Here's the thing, though. If the issue is
it's
more
like a 4-hour podcast,
it is. If the issue is more about the fact that you have two inexperienced players to win, then that's an issue that is going to resolve itself. If the issue is about a lack of X's and O's in scheme, that is not an issue that's going to resolve itself. And here's why I think the Huskies are in this position. Let's take a look at the recruiting classes from 2012, 2013, and 2014.
Which Lorenzo Romar
conveniently recruited. No one ever talks about when they talk about what an amazing recruiter Lorenzo Romar is.
So I just still don't understand this argument that you're saying, no, hold up, he's not actually a good recruiter either. He's bad X's and O's and a bad recruiter. That's your argument here?
Because
I'm becoming way more against Lorenzo Romar with you talking to me about being pro Lorenzo Romar.
Again, it's what is this going to resolve itself or not? That's the question. Question we have to ask.
What do you mean?
If the problem is that they had a bad set of recruiting classes 5 years, starting 5 years ago.
The problem is that he can't coach players once they're here.
I'm saying that that's not the problem. That people are... First off, by the way...
He either can't recruit good enough players or can't coach players once they're here.
Why does this work the other way? Why is it like Marquise Chris, what an amazing talent, even though he was a four-star recruit. But nobody's ever like, oh, hey, Abdul Gaddy. It turned out he wasn't actually as good as his recruiting rank, and we shouldn't hold that against Romar. Like, why is it always the coach's
fault? Abdul Gaddy got injured. He would have been good.
He was overrated in high school.
Somehow players from Seattle get overrated. It's very strange. It's the exact opposite of West Coast bias.
All right, here's the 2012 recruiting class.
Okay.
There was no 2012 recruiting class. I think there may have been a JC player in that, but it shows no player.
What was the year where they had that white guy? You remember him? He ended up at like maybe somewhere in like Pepperdine or something like that.
I mean, that probably applies to a lot of players, but I don't know specifically.
They had a class of like four players, and I think Coupon was part of
it. Yes, you're talking about the Pondexter class?
Yeah, and then everybody else left. His name was Phil something?
Yes, Nelson.
Phil Nelson?
Phil Nelson ended up at Portland State.
He ended
from
up being
Portland.
A pretty good player.
He was useful. Many of these guys end up having very good mid-major careers. 2013 class. This was a class that people thought was a really good class because of Nigel Williams-Goss. Nigel Williams-Goss was a good basketball player. Turned out he was not a good fit for the Washington program for a variety of reasons and ended up transferring after his second season. Darren Johnson, who transferred to...
LSU.
I saw this. It's some like Cal State Northridge, I believe. I looked this up the other day. Jamel Taylor had some good moments, but turned out not to be a Pac-12 caliber player. And I'm not sure he's playing at all anymore. And then Mike Anderson, who was a JC, went on to two solid years and then graduated. 2014.
Who's that guy from Rainier Beach, too? What's the younger Stewart?
Oh, yeah. Hakeem. They recruited him just so that they could keep good ties with Rainier Beach.
Yeah.
Yeah. He was not a Pac-12 caliber player. 2014. Donovan Dorsey transferred after last year and is sitting out this year at Montana as a transfer. Tristan Etienne, who was a Canadian power forward that they really liked, but for some reason decided he didn't want to play basketball as soon as he turned up on
Tristan's are just ass bags.
And then that Jaeger included both a Tristan and a Quevin. Quevin Winters.
And a Quevin.
Who was a JC transfer and did not play his second season of eligibility. Anyway, those are three classes from whom you could potentially have players now if those 2012 players were redshirt seniors. No players are left from any of those classes. So you look around the Pac-12. Who's left from those classes? UCLA has three starters from those two classes. Arizona has three starters from those two classes. So you know what happens when UCLA recruits Lonzo Ball? They get to put him next to Bryce Alford.
It's the same with Oregon.
And Aaron Holiday. And the other guard that they have, whose name is escaping me at the moment. You know, Arizona, when they get top recruits like Lauri Markkanen, they're putting them next to all these upperclassmen. And they're not asking them to do everything like UW is asking Markel Fultz to do.
Sure.
So,
but
again,
Lorenzo Romar recruited those classes.
They lost their way for a while. But again, no one disputes the recruiting results recently. And if you let Dickerson and Thibault and Chris become upperclassmen and become the kind of experienced leaders who have been key parts of the best Lorenzo Romar teams, and then fill in with the younger talent around them, the never-ending supply of Porter children, that's when you have success.
Yes. No, I think Lorenzo Romar deserves one more year. He gets through Michael Porter, right? That's it. And if they don't have results next year with Matisse Thybulle as a junior, David Crisp as a junior, Noah Dickerson as a junior, if they don't have results then it's over.
Okay. Now, can I make the one argument that is a legitimate argument as to why the Huskies should change coaches, which people don't make enough? Is that Romar has never adapted to the defensive rules changes that went into play in 2012-13, I think. since then, the best the Huskies have been defensively is 64th in the country last year, which actually was not that bad, but still was not good enough to get them into the NCAA tournament. And this year, obviously, the results are as bad as we all know they are.
Because he played a high-pressure defense.
And then the number of fouls may make it impossible to play that style of defense anymore.
Okay.
That's the argument that people should be making, because that's the thing that's not going to change.
Let's not talk about Oregon State. We don't have time to talk about Oregon State.
All right.
They're Oregon State. Who cares?
Their star player, Trace Tinkle, son of their coach, Wayne Tinkle, has not played in the last few weeks. Sounds like he probably will return for this game, according to what I was hearing tonight. So,
it'll be a tough loss. Just give him one more year after this loss. They lose to Oregon State. Start the season 0-3, playing two of the worst teams in the Pac-12 in that stretch at home. Should we talk about Husky football?
We should.
People who can actually coach.
You know how many coaches it took the Huskies going through to find Chris Peterson? Do you want me to count them for you?
I mean, Chris Peterson's in a different level.
He is.
Lorenzo Romo's not in the Chris Peterson level.
No. But I'm not arguing that.
Can we?
But I'm saying that there's a lot of Tyrone Willinghams out there that you could hire. There's a lot of Keith Gilbertsons out there you could hire.
Do we want to talk Peach Bowl? Relatively,
I just don't know how much there is to say. I feel like we had this one fairly well pegged.
Okay. First off, I have to say, both of us randomly, before the Peach Bowl, decided it was the Chick-fil-A Peach Bowl.
That's true.
On the day before the game, both of us separately and randomly, to prove that we're brothers, both went to Chick-fil-A. For me, the first time ever.
In my case, it was mostly convenience, because it turns out there's one in Beaverton, and it was right on my way back from Hillsboro as I was driving back on Friday morning.
I said I had to do it because of fate.
But you also, fate also placed you again near a Chick-fil-A.
Right next to a Chick-fil-A. And I have to say, so I got the regular chicken sandwich, waffle fries, and a side of buffalo sauce, as advised by loyal listener David, who went to college in Georgia.
In Atlanta.
In Atlanta, and has had a lot of Chick-fil-A.
As one does in Atlanta.
I gotta say, it's just fine. Chick-fil-A is just fine. I really don't get the appeal of Chick-fil-A.
I mean, I think the chicken for like a fast food chicken sandwich is amazingly good.
The chicken's fine. I said to you this the next day, we're eating Heaven Sent Fried Chicken, which is the real Lizelle's fried chicken. I would much rather have, if you took Heaven Sent chicken strips and put them onto a bun, you have a better chicken sandwich than you have a Chick-fil-A. And there's not an insane line and an off-duty police officer guiding traffic.
I agree that it is not worth waiting in line for Chick-fil-A. I will grant you that. I don't know, though. Like, the most recent time before this that I had Chick-fil-A, it was in the Detroit airport, of all places. And, like, even in an airport, it was still really quite good.
I would say that Chick-fil-A's taste was equivalent to the Husky football performance in the Chick-fil-A Bowl.
It was fine.
It was just fine.
It was satisfactory.
Yeah, it met expectations.
I went to Screen Door in Portland the day before for breakfast.
You can't compare those.
No, I mean, that's what I'm saying. That's why I made the comment for a fast food chicken sandwich.
The chicken at Screen Door is like, how did they even have this? I've never had chicken that tastes like this.
I don't know. It's magical.
Look, when we get to farther into the spring, once football is over next week, once football is over, hey, and we don't want to talk about Husky basketball, we're just talking about Portland food. Right? Agreed?
All right, that's fair.
Okay. The one takeaway that I had from this game, first off, I thought the defense obviously played great. We all agree.
Yeah.
Defense played a great, great game, got Lane Kiffin fired. Nothing. There could be no higher compliment for them.
I don't think they got Lane Kiffin fired.
Oh, they got Lane Kiffin fired a little bit.
A little bit.
The defense played a great game and couldn't tackle Bo Scarborough.
Yes.
Which, I was going to say, a lot of people can't, but I mean, it's not like he did not have that game against other teams.
No, that was kind of a new thing.
And I think part of the reason that they got Lane Kiffin fired is that they didn't hand Bo Scarborough the ball every single play.
I feel
they got way too cute in that game.
I mean, they won by 17 points. Like, the goal is not to win by as many points as possible.
I mean,
is to get to the championship game and be successful there. And I don't think giving Bo Scarborough 30 carries would necessarily have been the best way to accomplish
that. The offense had 17 points.
Won the game by 17 points. It was the outcome of the game was never in question for Alabama.
After that drive. But to me, the
in the second half, yeah, okay.
To me, the difference, obviously, the difference is Alabama's defense. They're the best defense probably in college football history. Everybody agrees. I'm actually really curious to see what they do against Clemson.
Very curious.
And if they just destroy Clemson, then we'll feel great about ourselves.
We will.
And especially,
by the way, was there ever a moment during the Rose Bowl where you were like, maybe it would have been better to just play here instead?
I don't know. Penn State looked kind of good.
Penn State did look kind of good. But I feel like we could have handled their garbage.
I think we could have handled their garbage.
They're like, quarterback runs around and runs the same, scrambles the same direction every time. USC did not seem to adjust to that. And then he was a 40-yard pass down to outfield.
Better than they would have, than they did.
Yes. Granted, we scored like 13 points against USC. They scored 42.
But to me, the difference and the big takeaway from it is about the offensive line.
Really?
And I think that's where everything started, and that's how they could have made a difference. Look, wide receiver separation is one thing. Wide receiver separation is not about individual wide receiver ability that much as it is about time for wide receivers to separate.
I don't know. To me, the number one takeaway was Jake Browning's accuracy has to get better. If the Huskies are going to compete at that level, Jake Browning has to be a more accurate quarterback.
He had time at various times, but when you look at it, and if they could have run the ball, which they can't, and nobody really could against Alabama.
Yeah, I don't put that on the offensive line.
If they had a line that could match up with that Alabama defensive line, they could have had a little bit more room to run the ball and then more time to pass the ball to give John Ross the opportunity to get open, to give players the opportunity to get open. Because Jake had to get the ball very quickly. I mean, granted, Jake was flustered. Everybody would be against Alabama. You know, I'm curious to see what Deshaun Watson looks like against Alabama. He's obviously played them before and is a much more experienced quarterback. But if they had a line that could match up with Alabama, they could have done a little bit more. Just having – all they needed was that extra little bit. The game plan was there, but they didn't have the line to execute it. And I think you go to Foster Sarrell, however much they're able to communicate with him in this last week before Saturday, and you say the difference between the Huskies being a college football playoff participant and a team that can compete with Alabama is you.
That's a good message.
It's not necessarily about anybody else in the field, because I believe, and we'll talk about this in a second, that they're able to find defensive players to fill in for the players who are leaving.
I mean, I guess the good news about the offensive line is 4 of the 5 starters are coming back. We'll have an additional year of experience, particularly probably helpful for Nick Harris, who's thrown in there, is a true freshman.
Yeah, it's insane.
And then asked to block Alabama's defensive line, and that's not fair. That is a lot to ask.
But I think it's just about that physicality that having a beastly offensive line can bring to you. And I think that's where it starts. And the defense, look, the defense giving up 17 points is few enough points to have won the game.
Yes. For sure.
It was just on the offense. And I think that's why bringing somebody like Foster Sarrell in and continuing to bring in the top-tier linemen is going to be so huge. It's the most important thing that I think Chris Peterson can do. And I hope that he takes away from this game that not that they need to get more speed or more complex, because they can do that. Anybody can get speed, really, and they have speed already, is that they need to get more physicality in the middle of the field.
I mean, I don't think that Coach Pete is going to neglect any position group, any area. Like, yes, he knows how to build a balanced roster. I don't have any concerns about that.
But to me, that's the number one focus for this team going forward.
All right, so let's talk about what's coming back next year, especially in the wake of the news earlier this week that Budda Baker, Sidney Jones, Elijah Qualls, and John Ross are all entering the NFL draft, none of which is surprising.
Yeah, pretty much everybody expected.
I think probably even less than perhaps you expected.
Who else? The Vita Vea thing was...
I mean, Azeem Victor had been pretty clear recently that he wasn't going to go.
Yeah.
Yeah, Vita Vea came kind of a little bit out of nowhere. There was also some LeVon Coleman talk. That's pretty much it. So you bring back 8 starters on offense, Jake Browning, both Gaskin and LeVon Coleman at running back, Dante Pettis and Chico McClatcher, so 2 of your 3 wide receivers, and then, like we mentioned, 4 of the 5 offensive linemen, and then the other position you lose is Jarrell Daniels at tight end. And I think we'd say at all 3 of those spots, you've got experienced players ready to step in.
Yes.
Andrew Kirkland probably plays left guard this year after playing right guard this year, maybe Nick Harris moves across the line. One of those two guys probably end up starting at guard. At wide receiver, obviously you have a rotation of players. You have a lot of guys in the mix. Aaron Fuller seems like he's the leader of that group, I would say. And then at tight end, another position where they rotated a variety of guys, and then probably Drew Sample is the leader there.
And well, Aaron Fuller is the leader of the group, but Chigo McClatcher is going to take the role.
Yeah. Yeah, I agree with that. Fuller takes the playing time. McClatcher takes the actual like spot in the offense. All right, defensively, then you bring back half of your... I went with 12 starters because of the fact that, you know, three defensive linemen, but they played most of the time in nickel, and Buda Baker really was a starter at nickel back, not at safety, even though he's still listed there usually. So that's on the defensive line, the aforementioned Vita Vea and Greg Gaines. You're replacing Qualls and then Joe Mathis, who... Or I'm sorry, just Qualls, because Joe Mathis were counting as an outside linebacker in this scenario. Jalen Johnson had a really good Peach Bowl. Looks like he's in line to step in there.
There are a couple players. Jalen Johnson, if he's healthy next year, being first and foremost defensively, to I think replace the Joe Mathis role. He's not necessarily going to be Elijah Qualls, but he is big. But the role of getting to the quarterback.
And then the other, you know, because of the fact that Mathis was out, so even though you're also losing Saul Mouchin, the other rush linebacker, you had Connor O'Brien was in the mix, Sione Potoahe was in the mix, a variety of players, Tevis Bartlett.
Yeah, I mean, really, that's what we were looking at in this game. Playing against Alabama, you have players Kevin Burke-Hervin, Tevis Bartlett, getting experience in this game. It's not like... You're relying on just, oh, it's like just this clear Joe Mathis, these people who you're losing, right?
Yeah,
the secondary to me is the biggest issue.
Yeah. And then Ben Burke-Hervin, actually, he probably won't start next year because you bring back both.
Did I call him Kevin Burke-Hervin?
You did. Yeah. Kevin was on the brain.
What about Kevin?
Keyshawn Bieria and then Azeem Victor coming back from the injury that ended his season. So then, yeah, the biggest question mark without question, yeah. So you bring back both safeties that ended up starting the season, JoJo McIntosh and then Taylor Rapp, who really came on at the end of his freshman year.
For sure. The other player, along with Jalen Johnson, who we're expecting to step up next year.
Yeah. And then it's cornerback. And that's going to be an issue because you're losing all three guys now. And that's where you really wish you had Darren Gardenhire. It would all make sense. It would all fit together perfectly if Gardenhire hadn't transferred late in the season.
Something happened there.
Clearly. But you have Austin Joyner, who would probably fit into that nickelback role that Buda Baker has made his own. Someone else who's got some safety experience, some cornerback experience, and some return and offense experience. Just that same versatility that Buda Baker brings. And then Jordan Miller at one outside cornerback spot.
The good thing about it is we feel confident in Coach Pete and the entire defense, the entire defensive staff, their ability to develop young cornerbacks.
I mean, you look at the first year that they were here, even extending across the defense beyond the cornerback position. But, you know, obviously at that point, Marcus Peters leaves the team, and then this group kind of steps up to replace him.
Yes.
And then also all the guys who got drafted after that.
Yeah, I mean, Shaq we saw Thompson a bigger exodus. That's the thing. We look at
Danny
next
Shelton.
We saw a bigger exodus of higher level talent. Maybe they weren't necessarily as dominant on the field overall, but higher level talent with Shaq Thompson, Marcus Peters, Danny Shelton,
three first round picks
and a second round pick. Yeah. So when you have, and we don't know what's going to happen with Buda Baker, Sidney Jones, and Elijah Qualls, but I don't think they're drafted that high.
It seems unlikely that there will be three first round picks from this defense.
So we've replaced this many good players before. And also, there are so many players who are experienced in the system. I have a bold prediction for you, though.
Oh.
I think Taylor Rapp moves to cornerback.
Interesting.
I think it's when we start next year, I mean, that's, Taylor Rapp
yeah,
is
that
a
is interesting because there is an abundance of talent at safety because in addition to those two returning starters I mentioned, you've also got Ezekiel Turner. Yeah, who has played a lot there. So, okay. Well, I'll be curious to see how that shakes out. We probably won't be talking much Huskies for a while here. I mean, I guess we'll talk about Foster Searle's decision next week.
In a recruiting day special, signing day special.
That's what I was saying was going to be the next time, but that's, I think, a month from now.
It's going to be huge. I mean, that's the biggest commitment for the entire class.
Yeah.
Keeping him home. But at the same time...
You got to build the wall. But sometimes guys just don't want to stay at home. Yeah. Sometimes guys just really
just
want to play at Stanford.
Love with Stanford. the difference between hating Foster Searle and loving Foster Searle. I mean, I guess it was the same thing that kind of happened with Buda Baker.
Yeah. I for one, will not be hating any 18-year-olds myself, but you knock yourself out. Should we talk about NFL lines?
Let's talk about NFL lines. But I just want to say, I think we feel really good going into the offseason, despite the...
Really? We feel really good about the season where the Huskies went 13-2 or 12-2?
I'm saying we feel really good about the team next year. We're judging process here. Like, I don't judge outcomes. I don't know. I don't watch football the way that you do, maybe. I don't know if you were paying attention to the score, but I was just looking at the process.
What did your process say about the UW offense?
You know what? It was a good game plan going into the game.
It really... I mean, the funny thing is, like... I was wondering about this. Like, basically all their completions were scripted plays, and it was then after they went off script, could not complete anything. And I don't know how much of that is Alabama's adjustments.
I think Alabama adjusted.
There's a lot of talk about how quickly Alabama adjusts.
You see the thing where Alabama was their secondary was talking, not in this game necessarily, but was talking to the receivers, and were like, "You're supposed to make this cut there." Like, knew exactly what route every single player was supposed to make. I wonder, do NFL teams just know that every time, or do they just not care because they're such high-level physical players?
The actual answer is that offenses and defenses hate each other in the NFL, as we've learned.
No, I'm saying the opposing defense. Like, does the Seahawks secondary know what route every single offense is going to run on every play? Or do they just rely on the fact that they're the Seahawks secondary and are such an extreme level of physicality?
No, I mean, there's a high level of pattern recognition that goes on. It's actually less with the secondary probably for the Seahawks than it is with like the
D-line.
The underneath. But there's a lot of pattern matching is what they call it, so that they know how they're defending in that cover three.
Yeah. Anyway.
So, NFL lines.
Okay. I'm very curious about this.
So... In case any of you are unfamiliar with the concept of a line, and if so, I don't know how you've made it this far in this podcast, but Vegas sets a line where there's hypothetically a 50% chance of the team winning more or fewer than this number of games in the upcoming season. You can bet on either of those. And then based on how people are betting, the value of those two things changes, so they're not, generally speaking, equal. And we've factored that in. I've got our total, like, our actual monetary outcomes.
Oh, really? Wait, does a tie count as a half, by the way? So, like, if you had 7.5 wins.
It does not.
Okay.
I'm pretty sure. I should have double checked.
There were a lot of ties this year.
There were. I don't think any of them affected the lines, though. Because, for example, we'll start with the Arizona Cardinals, one of those teams that had a tie. Their line was 10 wins. We both went over because we were tired of always doubting the Cardinals and being wrong. And they won 7.5 games.
You know what? I'm only going to judge our process on this. And our process was good of being afraid of the Cardinals.
Our process of reverse jinxing the Cardinals was outstanding.
Yes. It's impossible for us to really accurately do lines for the NFC West.
Exactly.
So if we're all wrong on every single NFC West team, then that's fine.
Next up, the Atlanta Falcons. Their line was 7 wins.
Insane.
We both went over that one.
Nice.
And we looked good when they ended up winning 11 wins, but we probably should have worked harder. Well, I guess we did reverse jinx them, but of course they still ended up number 2 seed ahead of the Seahawks. The Baltimore Ravens, line 8.5 wins. I went over, you went under the first time we disagreed on these, and they finished after collapsing at the end of the season. With 8 wins.
Yes, there we go.
That's one where I felt like my process was pretty good. They had a positive point differential. But
you'll count it as a win for yourself.
Carolina Panthers. Their line was 10.5.
Do you remember we argued about this? You were arguing like, they'll easily get to 10.5 wins.
Wait, that's odd because I took the under.
Did you?
Yeah.
Wait, we both went under?
We both went under.
It was just too many. But we argued about that. And then after the first week, are you sure you went under? Because I remember calling you after the first week against Denver. And I was like, how do you feel about that over bet now?
It's weird. I remember that same thing. But it says under on the spreadsheet. I don't think I went back and changed it.
Rigged.
Like, you'll... Okay.
Anyway.
I did a bad job of rigging it, apparently. Chicago, 7.5 wins. I went under. You went over on
did
the
Bears.
Did
they get to 8? I don't know.
Did they get to 8? No, they won 5 games. Excuse me, they won 3 games. They didn't even win that. They won 3. Did they get to 8?
They were a good 3 wins, though. You were just talking this last weekend about how the Bears have really solid skill position players in place.
I did.
Like, I didn't know that Jordan Howard was going to emerge, but I knew that the Bears had some things going for them.
All right, Cincinnati, 9.5 wins. We had a disagreement here, and a severe disagreement. I went under. You went over and made this one of your two locks.
Damn.
Which, unfortunately...
There was no process for locks either. You just called it a lock.
Cincinnati went 6-9-1. Cleveland, 4.5 wins. We both went over here. They went 1-15. Don't gamble, kids. Do not gamble. The Dallas Cowboys, a line of 8 wins.
Oh,
do you care
no.
to guess where we went here?
Was this a lock under?
It was not a lock, but we both went under. Obviously, the result was over. They went 14-2.
Well, we did this after it was announced that Dak after Tony Romo was injured.
Yes. But after watching Dak Prescott light up the Seahawks secondary in that last
preseason game. Preseason game.
It turned out it was predictive. Man. All right, Denver, 9.5 wins. Both went under here, and I made it a lock.
Oh, a lock under.
And had to sweat this out a little bit because they finished 9-7, but did win that one, both of us.
They won there last week. We didn't have to sweat it out.
Well, okay. I guess that's fair. Did they lose 2 weeks ago? I don't know. I think they lost 2 weeks ago. Detroit Lions, 7 wins. We'll be talking more about them later, obviously. I went over. You went under.
You went over?
I did. I liked the Lions to go 8-8. Instead, they went 9-7 and made the playoffs.
Pound my shoe on the table. Your process was terrible for that. They're like a 4-win team statistically.
That's a valid argument. We'll get to it. Green Bay Packers, 10.5 wins. I went over, you went under, and you got this. They went 10-6. Houston Texans, 8.5 wins. Under. They went 9-7 to win their division. I feel good about the process here now. They were outscored by 49 points this season. This was in no sense an above 500 team.
All this is telling ourselves that we feel good about the process.
There's some processes I don't feel good about.
I'm going to start highlighting the processes we feel bad about.
Indianapolis Colts, 9 wins. Both of us went under here, and you made this your second lock.
There we go.
And looked good as they went 8-8. Jacksonville Jaguars, 7.5. Do you remember Jaguars hype?
Look, there was Jaguars hype and Raiders hype, and one of those panned out.
There was, and I was skeptical on both of those, and I went 1-2. So my process was... they ultimately won.
Wait, what did we go for the Jaguars?
We both went under.
Oh, for the Jags?
Yeah.
Oh, good for us.
And they went 3-13. Kansas City Chiefs, 9.5. And I'm a little surprised we didn't make this lock because I remember us both pointing out that like the Chiefs always win 10 games under Andy Reid. And in fact, they won 12 games this year and we both went over
this
Look
one. Look at us. Great process.
The Los Angeles Rams.
Did we both say over?
7.5 wins. We both went under.
Oh, yeah.
They're not going 7-9. They're going 4-12. The Miami Dolphins, 7 wins. Both went under on this one. That was bad process. The Dolphins turned out to be pretty decent even when they weren't winning games. I guess actually they did have a below 500, below negative point differential, but they had an exceedingly hard schedule and still managed to go 10-6. Minnesota Vikings, 9.5 wins.
I still don't believe the Dolphins are a good team.
Well, again, negative point differential, so maybe you're right.
Okay.
Probably not a 6-win team, though. We both went under on their 9.5 win total.
Minnesota?
Yeah.
This was also after Teddy Bridgewater was injured.
It was.
Maybe even before they traded.
Before they were the last undefeated team. And lo and behold, that did not last, and they ended up winning 8 games. The New England Patriots. Guess what the Patriots over-under was?
11.
10.5.
My God.
We both wisely went over on this one, and they also went 14-2.
What in the hell?
That was easy money. That was a layup.
It was. They could have gone 0-4 without Tom Brady and still won that, right?
Yes, that is correct.
Yeah.
New Orleans, 7 wins. I went over. You went under.
Oh, I thought I went push. Did they get to 7 wins?
They won precisely 7 games. I think they should have been over. Positive point differential. New York Giants, 8.5 wins. I went under on this one. That was some bad process. You went over.
Yes. I think I went over on every single NFC East team, except for apparently the Cowboys.
Yeah. Yeah. They won 11 games. New York Jets, 8 wins. Over. The Jets actually finished 5-11.
Well, okay, so we were. I remember talking about this one too because they went 9-7, maybe even 10-6 last year.
They did go 10-6. I've got that on here.
And they looked like more or less the same team going into the season. I'm not even really sure what happened to the Jets.
I'm not either. They got really old, and then Ryan Fitzpatrick collapsed, and things got bad in a hurry.
Ryan Fitzmagic is going to be a great backup quarterback somewhere. Once he retreats into backup quarterback world, he's going to be a very solid backup.
According to the broadcast, he acknowledged the possibility that last week might be the last game he ever plays in the NFL if he's a backup and the starter doesn't get hurt. So there you go.
Okay. I mean, I guess that's true.
As we mentioned, the Oakland Raiders, they were very hyped coming into the season. 8.5 line. I went under. I was skeptical. You went over. And that turned out to be correct, is they won 12. They won a lot of games, suffice it to say. They nailed this over early. Philadelphia, 6.5. We both went under on this one. I'm not sure if this was... I think this was after the Sam Bradford trade.
But they were under, right?
Hmm? No, they...
They got to 7?
No, they got to 7. They won last week. That was their 7th win. Hmm. So we were wrong on this one. Pittsburgh Steelers, 10.5. We both went over, and they managed to get there with their late surge, getting them to 11-5.
I feel like this is the best we've ever done at these over-unders.
Well, we'll see. Some of us did good. San Diego Chargers, 7.
Hinting that you have this amazing over.
No, it's quite the opposite. I'm just saying. You're taking it wrong. San Diego Chargers, 7 wins. I went over. You went under. They collapsed this season due to injuries and ultimately ineffective play from Philip Rivers, and went 5-11. The San Francisco 49ers, 5.5 win.
Oh, no.
Under.
Okay, good.
Which was good as they went 2-4.
Those are always the scariest ones.
Yes. Because it's pretty tempting to take the over there. Seattle, 10.5 wins.
I went over.
We both went over, and they finished under. With.
But could have been, if they counted ties, could have been a push.
Would have been a push, yes. The Tampa Bay Buccaneers, 7 wins. We both went under here, and they did, in fact, get to 8 wins, or 9 wins, rather, and hit the over.
They were 9-7?
They were 9-7. Tennessee Titans, 6 wins. We both liked the over here, and lo and behold, they went 9-7. The Washington professional football team had 7.5 wins. I went under, you went over on this one, and you were correct since they went 8-7-1, just eked that out. So in total... Let's see, there were 22 teams we agreed on. We went 12-9-1 there with one push.
Okay, that's not bad, right?
Yeah. There were 10 teams we disagreed on. You won 7 of those. Yes. I won 3.
Wow, that sounds like my fantasy football record against you.
Something like that. And you, therefore, won this year, 19-15.
Nice.
So congratulations.
Wait, what is the money? Another toast. Wow.
Oh, yeah.
Fantasy football beat you at over-unders, had a baby?
So big week. So I did the bankroll. If you had bet $100 on each of these or something like that, you would have returned
something in that range.
I mean, I just don't know what total I use. You would have returned a 14.6% increase on your investment.
Really?
Yeah. And I would have lost 14% on my investment.
Wow.
So there you go.
Look at that. Man, this is the first year I think I've ever beaten you. And really, just with great process.
All right. So that's in the books. We'll talk about that again next September. But until then, let's talk about the Detroit Lions.
Let's talk about them. I mean, we mentioned earlier that they don't look like a playoff caliber team.
They don't. Their advanced stats are not great. So we talked about the point differential, which is a key stat. You know, the better predictor of actual team strength over the course of the season than wins and losses. Would you like to know how many, or would you like to guess playoff teams that had a better point differential this year, or non-playoff teams is what I meant to say. Non-playoff teams with a better point differential than the Detroit Lions.
8.
Well, just guess them.
Oh, guess the teams?
Yeah.
Okay, Tampa Bay.
That is a correct total, by the way. It's 8.
Tennessee.
Oh, no, it's 9.
9?
No, it's 11. It's a lot.
11?
It's a lot.
Okay, I'm going to be doing a lot of guessing here. I'm trying to go through it quickly.
All right, you did Tampa Bay and Tennessee.
Tampa Bay and Tennessee.
Tampa Bay is actually wrong.
What? They got to 9 wins and had a worse point differential?
They were minus 15. Well, Detroit got to 9 wins and had the same.
But, I mean, you're illustrating a point about.
That is correct. There was a lot of teams with below 500, or not a lot, but a good number of teams with below 500
okay.
records.
Tennessee.
Yes.
Baltimore.
Yes.
Denver.
Yes.
Washington.
Yes.
Philadelphia.
Yes.
Indianapolis?
Yes. Okay. I mean, you can just basically name all the non-playoff teams.
Arizona.
Arizona had the best point differential of any non-playoff team, so I'm very excited about pumping the over for them next year.
Buffalo.
Yes. I don't know who you haven't named at this point. I think
Carolina was the one that I was thinking about.
Carolina is a no. I think we're missing 2. I don't know. I've lost count, but
Minnesota.
You said okay, Minnesota, yes.
And New Orleans.
Yep.
That's all I can think of. I was going through all the teams in my head.
Washington. Did you say Washington? Washington. Okay, then you got all of them.
Okay.
All right, so yeah. So suffice it to say.
On fire. Had a baby. Won fantasy football. Guess the teams. Beat you in NFL betting
lines. But here's the interesting thing. If you look at advanced stats, DVOA, Football Outsiders DVOA specifically, even worse than their point differential. They ranked 27th in the league. Now, if you want to do a new list of teams that are worse than them, you know who gets added to the list? Were better than them but did not make the playoffs.
Okay.
The Jacksonville Jaguars and the Chicago Bears.
I told you those Bears are good.
Exactly.
I'd be a lot more scared if the Bears were 25. How many picks do you think Matt Barkley would throw in that game?
A lot. So the Lions won a lot of close games. A lot of close games. They trailed in the fourth quarter of basically all of their losses. It was one of the most randomly lucky seasons.
Of all their wins.
Or I'm sorry, yes. They also trailed in the fourth quarter of all their losses.
Close to the end of the game.
It's true. So you might ask, how do they do it?
Yeah.
And the answer is, I don't know.
Nobody knows.
Just kind of happened. It's the magical close win victory powers of Jim Caldwell. Who, by the way, is it a bad sign if you're going into the playoffs and you have to tell reporters that week that you're bringing your coach back?
I thought that was very strange. Is Jim Bob Cooter still a hot coaching candidate?
Well, he should be. We'll talk a little more about that in a second.
Because I haven't seen in the coaching carousel, maybe it's because he's coaching this weekend, too much Jim Bob getting interviewed.
He should be. So do we want to start with the offense? Because the offense is pretty good.
Okay.
It's average. Okay. It's about as good as the Seahawks offense. And in fact, strikingly similar splits. The Seahawks are 16th in passing and 23rd in rushing DVOA. The Lions are 13th in passing DVOA, 25th in rushing DVOA.
Okay. So let's start with Matt Stafford.
Yeah. And I think the big question here is, how much different is Matt Stafford after this sprained finger?
Yeah,
that he suffered in week 13 of the season and played with the last 4 weeks of the season. So since the injury, he's completed 60.3% of his passes for 6.9 yards per attempt with a 3.1% interception rate. 3.1% of his passes have been intercepted. Now, if you look previously at the previous, I think it's about 18 games he had played under Jim Bob Cooter after he took over as offensive coordinator midway through the 2015 season, notably after the Lions played and lost in Seattle.
Yes.
So under Jim Bob Cooter, he'd started throwing a lot more short passes, much more accurate, far fewer interceptions. And in that span, he'd completed 68% of his passes for 7.4 yards per attempt with a 1.1% interception rate. So basically, he's morphed back into pre-Jim Bob Cooter Matt Stafford.
Are they throwing the ball deep more?
A little bit. I mean, one of the things that's happened in that stretch.
Is it his finger or is it desperation? I mean, what's happening?
I mean, they have been trailing more in these games. So I think that is probably a factor in it. Their defense has just really struggled, as it should have all season. They've been without Theo Riddick, their receiving option at running back, who likes to split wide a lot. And even though Zach Zenner has been a really good receiver out of the backfield. Yeah.
Yes.
They have not thrown to their running backs collectively as much, and they've thrown instead a lot more to Eric Ebron, their tight end, and his yards per target have declined from 8.9 in the first 12 games of the season to 7.4 the last four. So that's interesting to know. But also something else, I broke this out, Stafford's completion percentage to wide receivers. First 12 weeks, he was completing 64.6% of his passes to wide receivers. The last four games, 55.8%. Now, the counterpoint is, last week was the only time they went against a below average defense in that span, the Green Bay, or below average pass defense, I should say, the Green Bay Packers. And Stafford really had quite a good game, even though they lost that game. It was primarily about what Aaron Rodgers was doing to them at the other end of the field. He only had 63% completions, but threw for 347 yards, 8.5 yards per attempt in that one. So
we don't know exactly why. I mean, you can't just 100% pinpoint, yes, it's the finger injury. It could be the defenses he's facing, which he will be facing a good defense this week.
But will he, though?
Statistically?
Not in terms of their past defense DVOA the last 4 weeks, or the last 5 weeks, I guess, without Earl Thomas, which you look at that same split. See, I said 30th in past defense DVOA in that span. I mean, That's bad.
mean, look, they're facing Jared Goff and Colin Kaepernick during those weeks. A lot of elite-level passing quarterbacks.
I mean, Kaepernick found a lot of holes in the Seahawks defense last week. A troubling number of holes.
What about the Lions' run game, though? It seems like they haven't been able to find... I mean, they haven't been able to find that one person. I think they don't have anybody over 100 carries for the year.
Well, they've had injuries there. Riddick, obviously, is more of a receiving option. They had Amir Abdullah early in the season. He's on IR now. Joik Bell was in the mix at one point. He's not a factor now. So it's down basically to Zach Zenner, the aforementioned Zach Zenner, who's been their most effective running back is a runner. And then Dwayne Washington, the former Husky, who's been wildly ineffective, but yet keeps getting carries. So let's hope for
but
Dwayne
I
Washington.
Still think he's a pretty solid player.
Exactly.
Still think he's probably underrated.
So that's the thing. You look at that combination of the Lions rush offense and the Seahawks rush defense. They're not going to get almost anything on the ground here, I don't think.
Yes.
You're going to see, if they don't complete passes on early downs, you're going to see third and longs. Yeah. And that's what they're going to want to try to avoid, because that's when Stafford has been getting pressured and throwing those interceptions. Now, they do have a pretty good receiving core. Ebron really broke out this year. He was sixth among tight ends in Football Outsiders DR, their value statistic. And then they've got a trio of wide receivers that basically sees the majority of their action. Marvin Jones is the deep threat. Anquan Boldin is the really reliable underneath guy. And then former Seahawk Golden Tate is, you know, kind of that a lot of quick screen type of thing, that sort of thing, where he's most effective.
And do you know anything about Marvin Jones' status for this game?
It sounds like he's going to play.
Okay. Pretty much everybody's going to play?
It sounds like it. Their biggest questions, I think, really were on the offensive line, where Travis Swanson, their center, has missed the last four games with a concussion.
Riley Reiff.
He has been practicing. Reiff missed last week with a hip injury, but it sounds like he's going to play. Both of those guys had limited practice on Wednesday, but the indicators are positive. But the guy who really scares me out of this group, and this surprised me because I didn't expect this before I looked at the numbers, is Marvin Jones.
Oh, yeah.
He's averaging 17 yards per reception. Fifth among qualifying wide receivers. And that is particularly terrifying given the Seahawks' complete inability to defend deep passes since Earl Thomas was injured. I originally wanted to boldly predict that Golden Tate was going to score a touchdown in this game, but instead I think it's Marvin Jones is going to score. That's my bold prediction, is Marvin Jones will score a touchdown of 30-plus yards.
Oh, really?
Yes.
Hello.
Yes.
So they look for to Marvin Jones deep, Golden Tate in between, and Anquan Boldin is their move the sticks receiver.
Right.
Along with Eric Ebron.
And Boldin, I think he's like 48 years old now. Is that correct?
That sounds about right.
The checkout. Still catching 70% of the passes thrown
this
way.
You see both him and Ebron are catching around 70% of the passes that are thrown to them.
Yeah.
So, I mean, it's working out effectively what they're doing. But let's talk about the Seahawks on offense.
Because that's where the Seahawks, if you can't get going against the Lions defense, it's just not happening.
Yes.
We may have said that against the 49ers defense. I don't know if they really got going, but they did enough there, I guess.
I don't know. I would not describe them as having got going against the 49ers at any point.
So the Lions have the worst pass defense DVOA in the NFL. And you were curious as to how that could be the case.
Yeah, because it doesn't look like they give up that many yards necessarily.
All right, so I did some research on this. Now, the first part of it is that teams don't attempt that. By the way, there's a long answer and a short answer. We're going to start with the short, long answer.
Okay.
And then get to the short
answer.
It's
about allowing three-pointers. And it's not about the three-pointers you take. It's not about the percentage. It's about how many you take.
So they've had a relatively low number of pass attempts against them, partially because of the fact that they're always trailing in the fourth quarter, whether they win the game or lose. Like, teams are always trying to run out the clock against them. So
I mean, that is the difference between, say, like 260 passing yards and 300.
Yes. So on a yards per attempt basis, they're seventh worst in the league. But that's still not as bad as worst in the league. So we had to go a layer deeper.
Oh, a layer. We're going a layer deeper.
We're going a layer deeper. So usually what we do to evaluate pass offense and defense is we look at yards per attempt.
Yes.
But you're missing some stuff there. Number one, you're missing sacks.
Okay.
And as it turns out, the Lions are really bad at getting sacks.
Okay.
The other thing you're missing is pass interference penalties. And it turns out the Lions are really good at getting pass interference penalties. I think they have the second most pass interference. They're tied for second most pass interference yardage.
Would you describe that
as third most, I should say. Okay. They're often do it. So when you add those in and look at actual yards per passing play instead of yards per pass attempt, they are now 30th in the league at 6.9 yards per play. And then the other comes in the short answer. Opponents are completing 72.7% of their passes against the...
Do they secretly have Brandon Browner in their secondary?
He wouldn't necessarily allow a high completion, but that would explain the pass interference. You know what the next highest completion percentage allowed is?
Wait, how many are they allowing?
72.7.
Okay. 66.
67.1.
Who's that?
That is the...
The Seahawks without Earl Thomas?
It might be. I haven't looked at that split, but that is actually the Dallas Cowboys. Now, here's another thing.
Interesting.
Here's a fun fact. So, did you hear that Sam Bradford set a record last week?
I did.
He did. He set a record for the all-time best completion percentage in NFL history for a quarterback. Do you know what completion percentage Sam Bradford had?
The same as 72%?
71.6.
The exact
same? The best quarterback in terms of completion percentage in NFL history is the average quarterback who played against the Detroit Lions.
Wow.
Think about that.
Wow.
So that's why they're worst in pass defense, DVOA.
Do you think that the Seahawks should even bother? I mean, what do the Lions look like against the run?
They're not good against the run. They're 23rd in rush defense, DVOA, and they're exceptionally poor in short yardage situations. One thing you mentioned is reading something about the Seahawks playing a lot of elite defensive lines this season.
Yes.
That how many games did they played against a Pro Football Focus top 10 defensive
line? I think it was 11 out of 16 games.
That sounds about right. They will not be doing that in this game. Obviously, the Lions used to have Dominican Sue as that guy who the Seahawks did play against in Miami. They traded for Haloti Ngata from the Oregon product.
From
Baltimore to replace Sue. But yeah, he's not the same player.
What about Ezekiel Ansah, though? Because I mean, I've read so much about him this week.
Well, he was limited earlier in the year by injuries. He had a sprained ankle that cost him 4 games. And after having 14 and a half sacks last year, he had 2 this year.
Really?
Now, the one thing is 2 of those came in the last 3 weeks. He had a sack in weeks 15 and week 16 before not having one against Green Bay last week because Aaron Rodgers can scramble however long he wants to. Their leader in sacks this year was Kerry Hyder, a converted defensive tackle who was on their practice squad almost all of last season and then had 8 sacks this year. But he was the exact opposite of Ansah. 7 of his 8 sacks came in the first 8 weeks of the season. In the second half of the season, he's only had 1 sack.
But I mean, we'll see what Ezekiel Ansah looks like. Clearly, he's not at 100% right now. He's not playing at his highest
level. It seems unlike him.
At his highest level of football that he could possibly play at. And this is, it's the one thing that the Seahawks offense can't deal with.
Pressure?
Yes. They can't deal with pressure.
I mean, that's the thing, is Russell should have time to throw this week. And his receivers should be able to get open because the outside of Darius Slay, who I think is still pretty good, even though the numbers don't necessarily back it up.
I look at the receivers and I'm like, do they do well against anything? They don't do well against number one receivers, number two receivers, other receivers, tight ends, running backs. They don't do well against anybody in the league. They're, I think, 29th or lower.
Yeah, you know how that happens? When you allow opponents to complete 72.7% of their passes.
There's not one place that you can look at and say, okay, the Seahawks clearly have an advantage here. It's just everywhere in the pass game.
I mean, that's actually maybe a concern. It's like there will be too many options for Russell Wilson.
I'm not concerned about that. Because all Russell Wilson cares about is finding the open man.
He does.
But it seems like...
God bless him.
It seems like there's not going to be... Hey, maybe Jermaine Kearse will have a nice game. It seems like there's not going to be one player who you can say, okay, Jimmy Graham's going to have a huge game. Paul Richardson's going to have a huge game.
The open man is going to have a huge game.
I think that the ball is going to go around to a number of different receivers. But I wonder, should the Seahawks even try to run the ball?
A little, but I thought one thing they did well against San Francisco is they used play action even though they weren't running the ball successfully. It turns out you don't really need to actually run the ball to run play action. No. You just have to have the idea that you might run the ball.
You just run the ball a lot. You don't need to run the ball well. Sure. I don't think they need to run that much to be able to continue to run play action. And I also don't think they need to run play action against Detroit.
I mean, they still should run some play action, but yes. We'll see. I mean, you know, maybe this is the week. I would like to see more of Alex Collins. He's continued to run the ball well. And I kind of liked what we saw from J.D. McKissic as a third down back coming out of the
just
backfield.
Anybody who's not Thomas Rawls. I mean, you look at the running back matchup. Let's assume that Thomas Rawls is the starter against Zeke Zenner. Just like, man, this is bad. I suppose. I can't think of two worse running backs going against each other in a playoff game.
I bet you could think of them if you tried hard enough.
I still think Thomas Rawls is a good running back, but it's a very bad running back matchup. At the same time, could I imagine Rawls getting going in this game? Sure. Do I think it's likely? Probably not.
Do you think it's necessary? Probably not.
Yes. And again, we kind of like the way Alex Collins is running. It would be nice to see basically even carries across the board, maybe you have slightly more for Rawls, a little bit less for Collins, and then a few for McKissick as change of pace.
I don't even know that he necessarily needs to run the ball. Just get him the ball out of the backfield.
Yeah.
Should we talk about special teams?
Yeah, what about special teams?
So the Lions have been really good at special teams this year. They rank sixth in the NFL, and that's almost entirely because of their punt coverage and punting, and then their punt returns. Andre Roberts is averaging 12.3 yards per punt return. He's actually displaced our man Golden Tate, usual punt returner for the Lions. And boy, would we kill to have Golden Tate returning punts right now. But he is third among qualifying players in yards per punt return. And everywhere else, they're basically average across the board. No real weaknesses in terms of their special teams.
Let's try not to punt the ball.
I like that idea. Yeah. So the interesting thing for the Seahawks, of course, is them signing legendary returner Devin Hester. To fill
right.
in.
Devin, okay, can I say it? Devin Hester, right? Clearly washed up.
Can we talk about that, though?
Okay, let's hear it. What do you have some Devin Hester numbers?
Do I have some Devin Hester numbers? Okay. What podcast do you think this is? Okay. Do you think this is the Adequate Pelton Cast?
Okay.
So Devin Hester this year has...
I think you might be lit right now.
We talked about Lorenzo Romo. I got fired up.
You argued me into thinking Lorenzo Romo should be fired. At the end of you talking, I'm like, I think Lorenzo needs to go. Anyway, go on.
Devin Hester averaged 24.5 yards per kickoff return this season, which is much better than the league average of 21.8. And if you look at the 21 players with at least 15-plus returns, ranks 7th among them. So he's a downgrade from Tyler Lockett, who averaged 26.3 yards per kickoff return, was the rare guy that makes it like sensible to return every kick out of the end zone.
Okay.
And I hope they don't do that with Devin Hester.
Oh, he's good. He's bringing whatever they tell him, he's taking him out. Devin Hester is not listening to anybody. He doesn't know those people. He's taking those kicks out. He was signed on Tuesday. He's running the ball. Anyway, what about punt returns?
Punt returns, Devin Hester may be washed up on. He averaged 7.2 yards per punt return this season. The league average is 8.6, and that ranked him 17th of the 21 players with 20-plus punt returns. Lockett was about average with 8.4 yards per return. Here's the other interesting stat from Seahawks special teams. What do you think is the worst aspect of the Seahawks special teams?
Place kicking.
Wrong!
I mean, I read your note about it.
Oh, okay. They're actually worse in terms of punt coverage.
That really doesn't make any sense.
Yes,
to
it
me.
Does. Because they keep having John Ryan kick the ball as far as he can and out kicking his coverage.
Record of giving.
Yeah, it worked perfectly. And then they were like, nah, we're good.
We're good. Let's just kick it as far as we can.
I mean, I think part of it is, again, God bless Pete Carroll. His greatest strength is also his greatest weakness. That is the man's incurable optimism that everything is going to work out for the best. So he's like, look, we should try to get as many yards on this punt as
but
we can.
But why was that not? Was he not optimistic when we were trying to get the fewest amount of return yards?
I mean, part of it probably was that the Seahawks were punching from better positions back then.
That's the thing that I think about punt returns. I don't necessarily want to fault Devin Hester because to me, return yards are more about. I mean, first off, the sample here must be tiny, but. Also, punt returns,
there are not that many returns, it turns out. Like, for everyone who's that worried about this, like, there just aren't that many returns.
Well, it's more about position than it is about. If he offers any level of fear, if he is able to take a punt return and give some fear to the defense, or let's say 1 in 1,000 times he's able to bring it back, that's a nice asset.
Because he'll get 1,000 returns with us. Yes.
But it's mostly about situation. It's not about the individual player that much in the situation, especially with punts. But to me, the biggest thing about Devin Hester is how interesting it's going to be when we look back on this. And in like 2030, we're going to be hosting this podcast as old people. Our children will be the hosts.
We're going to be old people in 13 years?
I already am.
How old do you think we are?
2030 seems like a long time from now.
In the distant future.
In the year 2000.
To borrow your LiAngelo Ball tweet. 2030 is closer to us now than the year 2000.
Wow. Mic drop for that one. It's how fascinating it's going to be. You're going to be like, and remember, and do you know who was returning kicks in that game? And I'm going to be like, who was it? And you're going to be like, it was Devin Hester. That's really what Devin Hester is an interesting trivia nugget for the future.
Like Jerry Rice.
Yes. Well, Jerry Rice played more or less a full season.
He did. He played a few.
Devin Hester came before the playoffs.
God willing, Devin Hester will play 4 games.
I was considering, so we had talked about the playoff possibility before we do percentage chances of victory. I had always looked at it as the Seahawks could host another playoff game if the Packers made it through. The team that I didn't really consider was the Giants.
Yes, that is true.
Basically, because the Giants have beaten the Cowboys twice.
They indeed have.
Basically, the winner of the Packers versus the Giants. I mean, that's the only opportunity we have. But
I mean, either of those teams is scary in the second round of the playoffs.
Either of those teams is scarier than any of the teams. Well, obviously, either of the AFC wildcard teams.
But I guess, by the way, the thing we didn't mention here is, man, everything broke perfectly for the Seahawks with getting the Lions.
Well, yeah.
We could be regretting this, but the process is good.
That's all that matters. That's all we care about. When we watch the game, we're just going to be saying the process was good to be here. Process would have been a lot better if we had a bye week, though.
That process is way better, including its possibility of the pro-size process.
Pro-size.
Trust the pro-size.
All that said, percentage chances of victory against Detroit.
80?
I was going to go lower than you.
Interesting. I mean, the implied line does say lower than this, but
I think it's about 75%. The Seahawks should win this game.
They should.
If this was a regular season game and we were going into it, we'd feel pretty confident going into the game.
Which we did going into that Lions Monday Night Football game last year.
Yeah, well, I mean, that one they definitely should have won.
Yes.
I mean, they did win, but they should have won much more comfortably than they did and not have needed a potentially illegal play to lose.
Potentially illegal?
Look, I'm not willing to go all the way.
Okay.
I'll never admit anything. But I don't think the Lions are coming in playing great football. I mean, obviously they're not. They're clearly not a great football team. Matt Stafford is injured. The only thing that scares me just a little bit is them just being kind of a young team playing a playoff game. Maybe they'll be a little bit more up for it. Seems like the Seahawks are a little bit out of sorts. I'm fascinated to see what happens. Russell Wilson is talking about taking off his knee brace. Have you seen this?
I have seen that.
I think it'll be, if it does happen, I think it would be a good thing.
Oh, I didn't mention that, by the way. Yeah, Russell Wilson has rushed for more yards than Matt Stafford.
Really?
But not nearly as many yards per attempt. Matt Stafford has been a surprisingly good
scrambling Matt Staff.
Yeah, it was like, so he's like, he's 14th in DVOA and he's 8th in QBR. And I was like, wait, why? And then it turns out he's run for 7.4 yards per carry this season.
Okay. Watch for the Matt Stafford scramble.
Yeah. You heard it here first.
But I do fear them a little bit just being maybe a more together team and ready to play this game and caring more about it. It feels like the little bit of the Seahawks feels like it's been such a messy season for them.
I don't buy that even remotely.
I'm just throwing this out there as a possible idea.
You're throwing it out there and I'm swatting it.
I'm saying they look like a team. Look, Pete Carroll teams compete no matter what. But they don't.
You're either competing or you're not.
They don't feel the most together, and they feel a little bit like a team that's ready for the offseason. Russell Wilson feels a little bit like he's ready to put the season behind him and start over anew.
I don't buy that even for a second. I mean, much like Pete Carroll, Russell Wilson is relentlessly optimistic. Like, as Bill Barnwell once tweeted, one of my favorite Barnwell tweets of all time, like, if your life had gone the way Russell Wilson's life had, you'd probably believe that things were like fated from above, just like he does. Yeah.
So like, I don't know if he's ever won a fantasy football title, beaten you in NFL betting lines. There was something else that I did in there too.
Something.
Something else, and had a baby in the same week. In that order,
successfully named the teams
in that order of importance.
Successfully named.
Oh yeah, successfully named the teams that had better point differential than the Lions.
With an unlimited number of attempts.
Like, I'm scared of every team, I guess is what I'm saying.
It's one game playoff. Anything can happen.
And the Lions have had an ability this year to win games that they shouldn't have won, and this could be one of those games.
This is another scenario where a past performance is not indicative of future performance to me. So they might win the game by playing worse, but there's no better chance of them doing it than, you know, the Arizona Cardinals doing it when they'd underperformed.
If we were playing the Cardinals, we'd lose by 3 or 4 touchdowns.
We'd be scared. Yeah.
I'd be much more scared of the Arizona Cardinals. Any of those teams that you named, let's say the Broncos were coming to town, no chance of winning.
But the point was the Cardinals had the opposite season where they've been a better team but had a worse record.
Yes. Look, would I rather be playing anybody besides the Lions? Probably not.
I mean, I'd rather mind be playing the Browns.
Well, I'm
the
saying
Niners
of playoff
again.
Teams. Let's say that, you know, Connor Cook was coming to town. Sure.
Yes.
But of teams in the NFC, it is the best possibility for the Seahawks to advance to the next round. And we'll see what happens.
Can I give you another fun stat?
All right.
That I looked up, but I didn't have any specific place to put
it. This is like literally an hour and 40 minutes.
It's only an hour and a half. Right. If the Seahawks win Saturday, they will have as many playoff wins under Pete Carroll as in the previous 34 years of franchise history.
Wow. And that's the thing, is people were down in the season, and this ranks like the sixth best win total of Seahawks history.
People are so
it's
spoiled.
Like the previous 4 years, and then this season.
I mean, I can't really say in my lifetime, because the Seahawks were good in the 80s when I was alive, but did not either know or care about football.
They're going on a pretty long stretch of being a pretty good team.
They have. But I'm saying, from like when I started to care about football, which we'll define as 1992, the year they went 2-14.
Pete Carroll's not lost a home playoff game.
He has not, no. The Seahawks have not lost a home playoff game since the 2004 St. Louis Rams.
Yeah.
Who were one of the worst playoff teams ever by TVOA and still came into Seattle and beat the Seahawks.
Were they? Wow, that doesn't portend poorly. Feel great about that.
They were much worse than this year's Lions team. They were like 2010 Seahawks bad.
They beat us. That's saying that they were much worse doesn't make me feel better. Again, he still recruited the players. They were a much worse team, and they came in here and won. That's worse than this.
From when I started caring, like the first 7 seasons I cared about the Seahawks, they didn't make the playoffs. So like, I'm not going to be unhappy about the fact that, oh, they weren't a championship contender as much as we hoped.
I guess so. I'm still unhappy about so many things.
I mean,
like,
you know,
I'm still
look,
so...
hey, the season is still going, okay?
Vinny Testaverde, come on.
Oh, no, I agree.
That's what I'm saying, is I'm unhappy about things going back decades.
I don't disagree with you. I'm just saying, I put this season in the context of, like, all of Seahawks fandom, not in the context of just the last 5 years. And, hey, why aren't the Seahawks winning every game?
Sure. I feel great.
Yeah, okay. All right, on that note.
Thanks for listening.
Thanks.